Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Will Libya be America's next quagmire in the Middle East? Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International. President Obama says chaos in Libya is one of his major foreign policy failures, with three rival governments all beset by the forces of ISIS. But the president's not giving up on trying to establish some kind of order, and U.S. special op forces could be sent there any day. Critics say it's a strategy that hasn't succeeded before, and they warn about making things worse with American lives on the line. We'll hear about possible options and what it's like on the ground. Today's talking point, Kosovo. Once a budding democracy, is now a hotbed for Muslim extremism in the Balkans. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The U.S., NATO, and the United Nations are focused on ISIS in Iraq and Syria, while ISIS commits all too familiar atrocities in another country, Libya. U.S. special op forces may be sent in, but with three rival governments, there's hardly a formula for easy success. Today's talking point, Kosovo, once was the most pro-American nation in the Muslim world. Now, with funding from Saudi Arabia, clerics are preaching Islamic fundamentalism. We'll hear what's happened since independence in 2008. First, this news update. A month after whistleblowers testified before Congress, airline passengers are still fuming about long lines. Now, the security chief of the Transportation Security Administration, Kelly Hogan, has been replaced. Frederick Kunkel writes the tripping blog for The Washington Post. It's about the experience of travel. Freddie, good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Experience, not what it should be for a lot of people. What do those whistleblowers have to tell Congress?
Well, basically, they said that anytime people would come forward with serious concerns about how the agency was being run, they ran the risk of being punished themselves. And the current administrator, Peter Neffinger, basically was defending the Kelly Hogan right before he decided it was time for Kelly Hogan to find other work.
So there has been a change at the top, but what might that mean for the passengers in the airport?
Well, it's a little unclear at this moment what it would mean, his change right away. I think that Neffinger basically just has his hands full. I think he came in with a mandate to really improve security. One of the issues, as a matter of fact, was that the TSA was not tapped into other intelligent networks in helping them to vet aviation employees, and they found out that a substantial number of people had received security badges when they shouldn't have. And presumably that's the area of intelligence that Hogan was dealing with. But he's also, they had reports of undercover operatives smuggling illegal weapons and fake bombs past the security checkpoints. So Neffinger has really tried to beef up security, instituted an academy, trying to retrain workers to do a better job catching stuff, detecting stuff. But on the other hand, with the rising number of travelers and with perhaps not anticipating this crush enough or moving the right people to the right places, we've had these crazy lines where thousands of people have missed their flights and are just fuming, and Congress is hearing about it.
The man who's in charge of all this, of course, is the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson. Earlier today, he appeared on NPR's Morning Edition.
A number of senators and I have asked the airlines to consider
eliminating the check baggage fee. But in addition, there are other things they can do. More aggressively enforce the 1+1 rule when it comes to carry-on, and airlines are doing that. Some of the airlines have stepped up and offered some of their own personnel to assist in the non-security aspects at the checkpoints.
What about eliminating the checked baggage fee? How do the airlines feel about that? And would more people check their bags rather than trying to get them on the plane?
I sure think that people basically respond to market incentives. And one of the things I came across was an item written by a colleague of mine, former colleague of mine, in the Washington Post almost 6 years ago. And she just told the anecdote of a traveler who went to Reagan National Airport, was told that she basically would be paying $25 or $50, I forget now actually, for the suitcase to be checked, and ran into a store and bought a $6 nylon bag and stuffed everything she could out of the suitcase into the bag and then used a Whole Foods tote to carry the rest. And I think that just really captured the kind of incentive people feel, which is they don't want to pay those fees. And so you see people bringing, you know, fairly large, yes, they're within the guidelines by TSA, but they're bringing these large suitcases onto the airport. And we've all seen these sort of death-defying acts by the flight attendants and passengers cramming these things into the overhead bins. And, you know, you wonder if you're going to get your neck broken. I mean, it just seems crazy, and people are doing that, I think, largely to avoid fees. They also do it because they don't want to lose their bags or they don't want to wait at check-in. But I think the fees have had an impact on that, despite what the airlines say.
Are the airlines making big money on those fees?
I don't know how much that adds to their bottom line, just the baggage fees. I do know that, you know, the fees have certainly helped their profits in recent years. I will tell you that the airlines insist that the baggage fees have nothing to do with the long lines, and strenuously make that point.
And Congress, though, has also cut the TSA budget. Doesn't that have something to do with the problem?
That has also been argued that, yes, they have cut their budget for several years. Just in the past year or so, though, Congress has also reversed course and tried to shoot a lot more money over to the TSA to beef up on the number of screening officers.
And as to the fees, there are those who would pay more just to make sure their bag actually gets to where they're going because there have been so many lost bags, as you indicated earlier.
That's correct.
All right.
And yeah.
Travel, not what we would hope, at least at the moment. Freddie Kunkel with The Washington Post, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Glad to be here.
In a moment, will Libya be America's next quagmire in the Middle East? On To the Point from PRI.
Santa Monica Bay's public radio station, KCRW, relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. After NATO troops helped to overthrow his regime, Libya's brutal dictator Muammar Gaddafi was killed by his own people in 2011. 5 years later, ISIS has established a significant presence in Libya, while the UN tries to unify two separate governments. At the same time, a third group is battling for power. This week, Secretary of State John Kerry announced a new plan to help the government endorsed by the UN succeed.
Libya has an opportunity to be a safe country for its citizens, or could be a safe haven for terrorists, trapped in division and chaos, and beset by personal, international, and tribal rivalries.
Now, after a NATO meeting in Brussels, the chair of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, said special operations forces could be sent to Libya any day. First, though, let's hear what it's like there on the ground. Letta Taylor spent 6 days in Libya last month. She is a senior researcher for terrorism and counterterrorism at Human Rights Watch. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
What did you find when you went there? It's been described as a place where it's pretty uncomfortable just to stay alive.
Yes. Well, I was in Misrata speaking to residents who'd fled Sirte. Sirte is the new ISIS stronghold, its largest stronghold outside of Iraq and Syria. And the people who fled Sirte were crying, men and women, as they spoke to me about the suffering that they have endured under the hands of ISIS. They spoke of people who'd been executed and hung from poles, men being flogged for smoking cigarettes or listening to music or allowing their female relatives to go out fully covered, but perhaps not with black gloves matching their black abayas. No food, no medicine. People were desperate, and many thousands of residents are still trapped under ISIS. So there's no question that ISIS is getting away with its signature barbarities in Libya, and the concerns about ISIS certainly are real.
It's ironical that this is in Sirte, which was the birthplace of Muammar Gaddafi and also where he was killed.
Indeed, it's a cruel irony for the people of Sirte and the people of Libya that the city that was Gaddafi's hometown and last stand has now come under the hands of another force that is also being accused of atrocities.
Are we seeing then the same things or the same kinds of things in Libya that we have seen in Syria? Is this the kind of humanitarian crisis that we're now all too familiar with?
Well, we are definitely seeing a humanitarian crisis now in Libya. I would not say that it's anywhere near the levels that we have seen in Iraq and Syria. Excuse me, in Libya, we don't have the levels that we've seen in Syria and in Iraq yet. But the crisis is growing. More than 2.5 million people are in dire straits in Libya right now. There are at least close to 500,000 internally displaced people, people fleeing not just Sirte, but areas of conflict between the rival militias, almost all of which have records of serious abuse. And there's almost no medicine and care for many of these displaced people. So people from Sirte, for example, there's no shelters for them in cities such as Misrata, where they're fleeing to. Many are trying to find places to rent, but there's a lot of price gouging, and they were desperate for a place to go so that they wouldn't have to go back to their homes in Sirte. So, yes, it's a very serious humanitarian situation right now and growing.
I said there were rival governments in Libya, maybe rival militias, your term, is more accurate. I want to introduce Andrew Bacevich. He's author of the new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He is a retired Army colonel, veteran of war in Vietnam and the Persian Gulf, as well as a professor emeritus at Boston University. And, Colonel, it's good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
How is it that the UN, NATO, and the U.S., Secretary Kerry included, have decided that one or another of these militias is the one to support?
I mean, frankly, it beats me. I don't know. And I don't claim to have any particular expertise in Libyan politics. It seems to me that at this juncture, Americans, policymakers, citizens, should reflect soberly on our role in bringing about this catastrophe, a direct result of the misuse of American military power.
How would you describe that? Tell us a little bit more in detail.
Well, I mean, in 2011, senior officials in the Obama administration seemingly persuaded President Obama that the U.S. intervention in an ongoing Libyan civil war would provide then an appropriate response to a humanitarian crisis and also facilitate the emergence of some sort of a stable and presumably democratic post-Gaddafi political order. And the results of that calculation we see before us, a country thrown into chaos, a humanitarian situation that, as far as I can tell, is orders of magnitude worse than the conditions that existed under Gaddafi. So I personally am troubled by what seems to be the inclination of the Obama administration to include General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to, in essence, take another stab at employing U.S. forces, even on a small scale, with the expectation that we are going to bring order and stability to that country. There is nothing to suggest in our larger involvement in the Islamic world that we have that capacity. And indeed, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that when we intervene militarily, the result is to make matters worse.
Andrew Bacevich, again, retired Army colonel, veteran of wars, and now professor emeritus at Boston University. Paul Shari is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He's also a former Army Ranger, having participated in special operations in Iraq and Afghanistan from 2001 to 2008. Thank you for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say to what we just heard from Colonel Bacevich, that the likelihood is that by sending in more special operations forces, we're going to make things worse rather than better?
Well, I think, you know, it's certainly possible to make things worse. You know, willy-nilly dropping arms around Libya would not be constructive. That's not what we're talking about doing here. I do think it is a little bit overly simplistic to imply that all types of military operations are the same. We're not talking about a large-scale occupation like the U.S. did in Iraq and Afghanistan. We might be looking at potentially a few hundred advisors on the ground on the high end, and that would be really to support this new fledgling Libyan government, particularly in their fight against ISIS. The goal here isn't to fix Libya. That's a task for the Libyans to do, and it's going to take a lot of time. There's, as you know, was mentioned earlier in the show, there's three different competing claims on the legitimate government of Libya here. What we're looking at is working with other countries around the globe to back now the UN-recognized government in their fight against ISIS. And the U.S. certainly has a stake in doing that.
Let me ask you the same question that Colonel Bacevich said he couldn't answer, and that is, how do we know? How does the U.N. know? How does NATO know which of these militias is, in fact, the fledgling government that we ought to support?
Yeah, so I am not either by any means an expert on Libyan politics. You know, this is right now the government that was brokered under a UN sort of sanctioned deal back in December in terms of a unity government. This is, you know, still Libyan politics is still fragile. It's uncertain. This government may or may not be around in a year or two. I think we're going to have to be willing to work with those who are willing to work with us to partner against ISIS, cognizant of what those dynamics are going to be on the ground in terms of if we're supporting people or strengthening certain groups, how that actually affects the Libyan political dynamics. So we're going to have to be very keenly aware of this. But sitting back and doing nothing while ISIS creates their largest safe haven outside of Iraq and Syria, that's certainly not constructive, and it's not in U.S. interest either.
All right. We've heard the basics of a debate that's going on in this country, and we want to come back to our guests with more on that in a moment. But first, let me introduce Mohammed Al-Jarz, who is a non-resident fellow with the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center in the Middle East. He is based in Libya. Today, he joins us from Tunis in Tunisia. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you answer this question? How do we know which of the militias is, in fact, the fledgling government that deserves support?
As your previous guests have said, it's a very difficult question. But for a Libyan, currently there is no single government, including the UN-backed government, that represents all of Libya. And that is the problem that we have here. And if there is any support that's going to the UN government or the UN-backed government that is not representative of all of Libya, it actually only controls small parts of Libya, then you are only supporting one side of an ongoing conflict. And you are basically supporting it because you think this is the side that is able to defeat Islamic State. But that is not true. For example, the UN-backed government does not have any influence or control on eastern Libya or the Libyan National Army led by General Khalifa Haftar, for example, who also claims to be fighting Islamic State since 20 or terrorist groups since 2014. So I believe that if anyone claims that they know that this is the right government to support or this is the right group to support in Libya are definitely making a very crude assumption there.
We heard Paul Shorey earlier say that not all interventions are the same and that this isn't just the idea of dropping arms. But is there a concern that if you arm one faction, in fact, those arms may end up with a rival faction?
That is precisely what happened in 2011. Some of the weapons that were delivered in 2011 ended up in the hands of groups that were later designated as terrorist groups, including Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi, in Derna, and in other parts of Libya. So that is a real possibility. But the other issue that we need to consider here, if we are going to support one side of an ongoing conflict or low-level civil war, once even you finish Islamic State like you finished we finished Gaddafi in 2011, then you risk that these weapons will be used in a full-fledged, full-scale civil war as well, which will result in a new kind of instability, new kind of suffering, etc. And this, again, requires that a lot of work is laid first and a lot of groundwork done to unite as many of the key factions on the ground before supporting any one of them, and also the structures that the international community or the United States would work with have to be designed first. But currently just saying we will support the UN-backed government is going to backfire seriously.
Paul Shorey, let me go back to you with the New American Security. Center for New American Security, former Army Ranger. What do you say to this? And is it possible that special operations troops could be sent in there in a situation where they would be put at great danger without there being much chance of success?
Well, the U.S. interests here are to fight ISIS. And so that's going to require some flexibility in terms of who we're partnering with on the ground. U.S. really shouldn't be in the interest of trying to pick a winner inside internal Libyan politics. That's not in the U.S. role. The U.S. does have a role to play in trying to help these groups come together to form some sort of broader unity government. I think one of the points that Dr. Basevich made that's very spot on is one of the failures that the United States had was after Gaddafi fell, walking away and not being engaged enough politically in trying to assist the various factions inside Libya to come together. But the U.S. role really is, how do we defeat ISIS? And that may involve partnering with multiple groups on the ground.
Colonel Basevich, does the U.S. make a mistake in trying to pick a winner?
Well, I think so. I mean, it seems to me that what we have is a consensus in this conversation. And the consensus is that there is no government in Libya, and it's impossible to say whether and when a government will exist. And it seems to me that having reached that conclusion, the very notion of U.S. military intervention becomes a non-starter. I don't think that the principal interest of the United States is to fight ISIS. The principal interest of the United States is to find some way to contribute to the restabilization of a region that we ourselves, sadly, have contributed to destabilizing. And the notion that further U.S. military action in a political vacuum is going to produce a positive outcome just seems to me to fly in the face of all that we have experienced in this region over the last 20, 30 years.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and later talk about Kosovo, once a budding democracy, now a hotbed for Muslim extremism in the Balkans. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Thank you. This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, once again talking about Libya and the potential for committing new American troops in small numbers, special ops forces, to that country, which all of our guests agree really has no government at all at this point, although NATO, the U.S., the U.N. Have in fact designated one of several militias as the one most likely to be able to set up a government. I want to go back to our first guest, Letta Taylor, with the Human Rights Watch. Isn't Libya rich with oil, and what's happened to that?
Well, first, I just want to mention that, in fact, there are three governments. The two governments, two of the governments are backed by rival militia. So it's not actually the governments themselves that are the militia, but they rely on these rival militia, which are in loose coalitions, for their support. I just not sure I was clear on that the first time around. Libya, yes, it is.
Don't go away from that. I think that's very important to make that that point, because I didn't make it either, and neither did our other guests. So there are then governmental institutions, and different militias support those institutions?
Well, yes, there are two rival governments in the east and the west, and now there's this third government that was brokered by the United Nations and the so-called international community, including the U.S., Italy, France, and the U.K. But that third U.N.-backed government is basically isolated to a naval base in Tripoli, and it, as the other speakers have also said, not one of these three governments has the support of a majority of the people. But what is propping up the two governments in the east and the west that are not confined to a naval base are loose coalitions of militias. And so that's basically how they are functioning at this point.
Letta Taylor, once again with Human Rights Watch. Andrew Bacevich, back to you, our retired Army colonel, author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, a military history, and a well-known spokesman on these issues. You said that our principal goal ought not necessarily to be to fight ISIS, but rather restabilize the Middle East, particularly because, according to you, we had a lot to do with destabilizing it. What about the other countries of the region?
Well, I think that that's the key. Other countries in the region are far more directly threatened by ISIS than we are. Indeed, I think you can make an argument that ISIS does pose an existential threat to some of those countries. And then we've been talking about Libya, but let's throw Iraq, Syria, maybe even Saudi Arabia and Iran into the mix. Those are the countries that need to step up to the plate. ISIS, when you think about it, is a relative. They may be vicious, but in terms of military capacity, they have modest capability. They don't have an air force. They don't have a navy. They have very few heavy weapons. They don't have allies. They don't have a significant resource base. And were countries in the region to step up to the responsibility to police that region, they could A, do it more effectively than the United States has, and B, that would enable the United States then to lower its military profile, which in my judgment serves the interests of the United States, not diving in more deeply, but trying to find a way to extricate ourselves from a situation that becomes ever more unmanageable the harder we try to fix the place.
Mohammed El-Jarr with the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, based in Libya, talking to us today from Tunisia. What about that, and why haven't the other countries in the region taken a greater role, particularly given the threat to them from ISIS?
Unfortunately, various regional players such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Qatar and the UAE have been playing a negative role in Libya because they chose to support what I would call their proxies in Libya rather than working for the stabilization of the country and a support of the unity efforts that are taking place. Instead, we have seen weapons flowing to, for example, from Turkey flowing to the powerful city of Misrata and to the former General National Congress and its government in Tripoli. Some of these weapons ended up being transferred to terrorist groups or terrorist designated groups in the city of Benghazi and in Derna. On the other hand, you have Egypt supporting General Haftar with weapons, ammunition, and the UAE as well doing so. So these regional players have not been playing a constructive role. And instead of working for the greater good of the region and of the Libyan people and the Libyan nation, instead their interests or their own interests have taken over. But that is not different from what we've just heard, that the United States' interest, for example, is just to defeat ISIS. It doesn't matter if there is a civil war in Libya. And I think that similar approach is being used by those regional players, even though they're more directly threatened by the instability in Libya.
Back to Paul Shari, the center fellow at the senior fellow at the Center for New American Security and a former Army Ranger. Tell us what the special forces, special operations forces that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff anticipates going to Libya would in fact do there.
Sure. So they'd have a number of tasks. They'd be training their counterparts, the militia members or sort of a nascent new army for the Libyan government. They would be supplying them weapons and then training them how to use those weapons, giving them advice and intelligence on ISIS and how to conduct a campaign against ISIS, and then maybe assisting through maybe information gained from U.S. drones or other intelligence sources on, say, where ISIS might be.
So they would be majorly then focused on ISIS. But what about this, the fact that there's essentially a civil war with all these militias fighting one another? Are the counterparts that you describe more likely to be interested in that than they are ISIS?
That's certainly a potential problem. That's a big problem in Syria today, where you have the multi-sided civil war, and ISIS is the main focus of the United States, but not the main focus for everyone on the ground necessarily. And that's certainly going to be an issue in Libya as well. And that's something the U.S. has to be cognizant of. I mean, I don't think the U.S. should be in the interest of picking a winner in Libya. That's not our role. At the same time, the U.S. can't be ignorant of the politics on the ground. And so the U.S. has to be able to work with the various groups and to try to get them to come together. But it's not the United States' job to fix Libya. That's really up to Libyans. But if we can assist Libyans in their fight against ISIS and assist those who are willing to come together to forge a unity government, then we certainly should be doing so.
What about Colonel Basevich's point that the United States had a lot to do with destabilizing the region? What we ought to do is try to restabilize the region. That's not really something that the special operations forces could do, is it?
Well, I think I'm not sure that I really agree with that telling of history there. I mean, the Libyan civil war was underway well before NATO and the United States got involved. Certainly a problem was that the U.S. was involved in an air campaign to help overthrow Gaddafi and assist Libyans on the ground and then walked away and wasn't engaged in the aftermath. So I think engagement makes sense. But this isn't about sending in U.S. troops or other Western troops to themselves stabilize Libya in an occupation. That doesn't make sense. That's not what we're talking about. No one is suggesting that. What this really is about is small teams of advisors that would assist the Libyans in security and in fighting ISIS.
Mohammed El-Jarz, if the United States had not walked away, as our other guests have put it, would American forces have been able to stabilize the situation, make it better than it is now?
I think walking away without a post-intervention strategy contributed significantly to the situation that we are in today. However, there is a lot of blame to go around, including upon us Libyans inside Libya and the various Libyan factions. But I think what is important is before any intervention or before sending any advisors or before trying to help or fix something, is to try and put a lot more effort into trying and understanding the real dynamics on the ground. And not just because I think what the United States is doing at the moment in Libya is trying to pick a side, and they are picking a side. And they think this is the best or the winner or the winning card for them in the fight against Islamic State. And that is a destabilizing thing for Libya in the future. This picking of sides will bring new kind of instability in the future and will contribute to potentially the partition of the country, again, bringing with it a new kind of instability that would give a perfect environment for other groups, other extremist groups or jihadist groups to spring up and continue to operate in Libya and use it as a safe haven.
Letta Taylor, back to you with Human Rights Watch. Your organization doesn't take positions with regard to policy, but are you concerned about a sort of slippery slope here? If a few U.S. forces go in, whether it's picking a side or just trying to help against the fight or help the fight against ISIS, is it likely to lead to more forces and increased activity on the part of the United States with casualties to come?
Well, I can't predict the future, but I can say that it's imperative that the United States and all parties to this conflict do all they can to protect civilians, because civilians are, this is the group that is suffering, whether it was under Gaddafi, now under ISIS. If care is not taken to protect civilians, the Libyan people will just suffer under a new form, under a new set of abusive rulers, even if ISIS is toppled. And one of our main concerns, as the U.S. and its allies become more involved in Libya, with the training comes, of course, weapons. Now, who is going to ensure that these weapons do not get into the wrong hands? And that could be, the wrong hands could be the people they're intended for if there's not proper vetting. Armed militias on all sides have committed war crimes and other atrocities in Libya with impunity. So who is to say that this will not happen again? What will the vetting process be in this chaotic country teetering on statelessness? How can there be a guarantee for respect for human rights? So I think that that is the slippery slope. Now, the UN Security Council has repeatedly said that it will impose sanctions on those who commit serious crimes in Libya, but it's essentially not slap sanctions on those who are committing human rights crimes or those who may be countries or individuals who may be aiding in those war crimes. It would really be helpful if the Security Council got serious and put some action behind these now empty threats to impose sanctions, because right now all sides in Libya know they can get away with murder, and that's got to end, and that's where the U.S. could start engaging seriously along with its allies.
Andrew Bacevich, again, you were the one who said you thought that there was a great opportunity here to make things worse rather than better. Do you think this is going to continue? I understand that General Votel, who was formerly in charge of special operations, has now been promoted to lead the CENTCOM. Are we going to see more then of this kind of strategy during the current administration?
Well, I'm sorry to say, but I expect so. I mean, once we make a commitment premised on the notion that a small number of special operations forces are somehow going to make a difference with regard to the fight against ISIS, when it turns out that small number doesn't get the job done, there will be an inclination to have the small number become a bigger number. We have seen that happen in the most recent war in Iraq, where we now have, 5,000 troops on the ground and a major air campaign. So once in, it becomes very difficult to extricate ourselves from this fight. It seems to me that we've got a pretty clear consensus that there is no Libyan state, but there are Libyan people. And to the extent that we care about the Libyan people, then it seems to me the proper response on the part of the United States and others is not simply to throw fuel on the fire of this war, but to take action to provide sanctuary to the Libyans who are at risk. And that means probably getting them out of the country and bringing them to places where they can be safe. not least of all, the United States of America, if indeed Americans cared about Libyans.
Paul Sharre with the Center for New American Security. Quick response, if you will. We're running short of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how we'd extricate all of the people in Libya out of Libya. That seems like that would be pretty impractical.
About the broader concern that if we send in a few, we're likely to be sending in more and making things worse rather than better?
Look, not everything is a slippery slope to everything else. There are very clear fire breaks that we can draw in terms of thinking about military operations. And a very important one is the difference between having advisors on the ground who are assisting others and having U.S. combat troops who are themselves directly undertaking combat operations to own and stabilize and secure terrain. And in Iraq, we have several thousand troops on the ground, but they are assisting the Iraqis. And so sometimes they may be in harm's way in the sense that they're conducting a raid like U.S. Special Forces did against bin Laden in Pakistan, but they're generally not themselves going out and owning terrain and fighting ISIS and seizing ground the way the U.S. did during the occupation of Iraq. And that's a place we shouldn't go back to. That's a model that is very costly and shows little for it, frankly, in terms of success. But sitting back and doing nothing doesn't make any sense either. That's what we did in the 1990s when it came to terrorism, and we ended up with 9/11.
Quickly, Mohammed El-Jarr, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're in Libya, you're based in Libya. You said earlier that this is a Libyan issue. What do you anticipate in the future? Are things going to get worse before they get better?
I believe indications seem to be heading in that direction, that indeed things will get worse, especially with foreign intervention or foreign assistance, etc., to an already protracted low-level civil war in Libya. There should be a lot more work done to unite Libyan factions, and there should be a lot more groundwork laid first before any assistance or any intervention takes place in Libya.
And is one possibility a divided country?
It is very much a possibility now, okay, with various competing governments and also governments that only control one part of the country. They have their own central bank, their own national oil corporation. They have their own institutions, basically. And the danger of a split, and some are now talking about a post-Sykes-Picot period in the region as well. So it is definitely a possibility.
All right. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Mohammed El-Arj, once again, at the Atlantic Council. Paul Sharre at the New American Center for New American Security. Andrew Basevich, America's War for the Greater Middle East, a Military History. And Letta Taylor with Human Rights Watch. Thank you all for giving us a lot to think about with regard to Libya. Kosovo in the Balkans. That is a nation transformed in just 8 years, and not all for the better. Back with that in a moment on today's To the Point.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney here with today's talking point. After the breakup of Yugoslavia, Kosovo gained independence from Serbia, and it was one of the most pro-American nations in the Muslim world. Now it's a hotbed of extremism and fertile ground for ISIS. That's according to a lengthy investigation by Carlotta Gall, foreign correspondent for the New York Times.
Thank you for having me.
You describe having gone back to Kosovo after having left it for some period of time, and finding it very, very much changed. And you say that there's a new story of misery and injustice there that needs to be told. How did this come about?
Well, that's the tragedy, that I worked there during the war and saw, you know, all those problems of the Serb oppression and then the bombing by NATO and then the revenge killings and so on. But then Kosovo was building itself, and it had UN protectorate, UN administrators, and it had peacekeepers from NATO and America, and it built a democracy. But at the same time, what we found out was that a lot of Saudi and Arab NGOs, non-governmental organizations and charities came in at the same time with the aim to rebuild and help the orphans, help the disadvantaged, rebuild mosques. But at the same time, they brought a very radical version of Islam and taught people and conditioned a lot of their aid on you'll get a stipend for your poor family as long as you come to the mosque. So they radicalized, or at least they spread a fundamentalism that allowed some really radical types to come in and lure people away to Syria. And now Kosovo has the highest per capita number in Europe of young people running off to Syria to join ISIS. So it's still a small number compared to the general population, but it's very alarming because this was supposed to be, you know, the nation built under the Western aegis to be a new democratic member of Europe. And a lot of the youth have been taken away from that to something much more extreme.
Did you notice a difference in the way people treated you, their willingness to talk to you, their willingness to discuss the phenomenon you're talking about?
You know, it depended who you talked to. A lot of them were very warm, especially when they realized that I covered the war. They have a great respect for a lot of the journalists who covered the war at that time because the ethnic Albanian population really suffered, and they welcomed the Westerners who came in, whether they were UN or NATO observers or foreign journalists. So there's still that great warmth, and they're very welcoming people. But then you found this new element, which is small, but it's very virulent. People who won't shake your hand, who glare at you, who call you Satan when you pass in the street. And I recognize them because I've worked in a lot of these countries. They are what we call Wahhabis, who follow the very strict fundamentalist version of Islam that's practiced in Saudi Arabia, or Salafis, other people call them. And they're very anti-Western. And so that exists now. And you see it in the streets in central Pristina, the capital. And you people will tell you it's infected their family. You know, their daughter refuses to go out anymore. She veils herself. And so on. And then a lot of the boys have been running off to join ISIS. So it's prevalent. You see it a lot. I think a couple of years ago, it was getting to a very dangerous time where people were actually complaining of aggressive vigilantes using violence or threats. And now the government is cracking down, so it's ebbed a bit. But you see it on the streets of the capital.
We've talked on this program about the spread of Wahhabism and how it comes out of Saudi Arabia on previous programs, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again. Why focus on this small Balkan nation so far away? What's in it for the Saudis?
Well, I think the genuine approach after the war, and we saw it in Bosnia too, they came in to help a Muslim population that had suffered in a war. That was genuine. I mean, Saudi Arabia spent $45 million in a few months at the height of the refugee crisis in Kosovo. So a lot of it was, you know, food aid and housing materials and shelter and so on. But what then happened was they took over the mosque building as something they said will do, and the West and the UN allowed that. And then what nobody looked at was the conditions attached, the education and the religious teaching that followed, and that's where the damage was done.
Are there now less extreme clerics who practiced Islam, I take it, in a very different way in the past. Are they fighting back in any way?
They have, but they've been pushed into a corner a bit. Some of them have been threatened. I mean, one I met was beaten up, nearly killed. But they have tried to push back, but they find it almost impossible with the amount of money that comes in. And it's not just building a mosque, but they then offer to, you know, these Arab countries, they then offer to pay the salaries and the running costs of the imams. And again, it's conditions attached. They have to teach the religion as according to the Saudi view. And so the traditional imams, what I would say, are very moderate, because they in the Balkans, Islam was always very moderate. It comes from the Ottoman legacy of the Ottoman Empire. It's a very quiet, not ostentatious type of Islam. And then from communism, a lot of them anyway don't practice. So the religion is a very gentle type, a moderate type. So those traditional imams, they have no money, and they can't really compete with these hugely wealthy foundations that come in and pay others. So there's now a pushback. The government now realizes the problem, and they've jailed and charged a lot of the radicals. But the sheer amount of money that comes in from the Gulf Arab countries is still changing the type of Islam that you have in this corner of Europe, and that's very hard to push back against when there's so many millions coming into the country every year propagating that.
Hard to push back against because there's no source of that kind of money on the other side.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, do you intend to go back to Kosovo? Do you plan to spend any time there? You were for a while. Now you're in North Africa. Are you going to move again?
I think there's a lot of stories to do around the world. Certainly what I am looking at a lot is the different aspects of this trend of fundamentalism that we see, whether it's in Tunisia, which is now starting to show in terrorism attacks, or somewhere like Kosovo, where it hasn't become violent, but it is changing the culture. So I think I'll keep moving and keep writing as much as I can about wherever there are stories. But I think certainly the Balkans is an issue, partly because of the migration crisis, partly because of the unemployment and economic problems. So certainly it bears watching.
Thank you for your work. Thank you for being on our program. Carlotta Gall with The New York Times. Great to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.